Okay, Mike Malevsky here, and I am privileged to be in Dan Renshaw's cabin on a sort of a sunny day with a temperature outside roughly, we're looking at a indoor-outdoor thermometer, and it says
46, which is a little suspect, but...
Yeah, 46 degrees maybe, certainly toasty warm inside, and I'm here...
Between there and 18, yes.
Okay.
Which is left over from a 40-inch snowfall.
So you get to be pretty expert at estimating this snow.
If I have an expertise, it's in trying to figure out the weather patterns as to what's going to create snow and what isn't. A lot of the storms will curl into Prince William Sound and look really ugly and give us nothing. That's the common thing. I look down at the valley and I see you guys suffering from high winds, but very little in the way of snow. The storms that we have to have for creating snow in the local area come up the inlet. When I see that pattern, why then I know I better get ready for some decent snowfall.
Well, today we're looking out this large window that looks right down the valley and toward what presumably is the location for Palmer, because right now there are clouds laying in there and obscuring anything of the valley below. Is that a common event?
It's not uncommon, meaning that it usually speaks of inversion. I'm warmer than.
Okay.
When I get that inversion, why, it's almost assuredly some fog in the valley. Summer and winter, but primarily the winter thing. Now, this has been an extremely thick layer, very, very substantial. Probably goes way down Cook Inlet, I assume.
But. Could be. That could be. At least at this point, we're in the sun, and yeah. we have high clouds, a little bit of blue, a little bit of cloud, and that's the rest of it. But I'm looking around the cabin, and I'm curious, what year did you first move into it and use it?
Well, the cabin next door, I'm pointing my finger here to the west, was the family home when I was a little kid.
Okay, so you're very familiar with that.
We lived there. It's changed a lot in the interior from the way it was then. This building is actually a duplex, and this west half was finished with fine detail by an excellent carpenter that my father had working for him while he was building the camp. And that carpenter was also his brother, Jerry Renshaw. So Jerry put a lot of time and effort into making everything right and made it so comfortable that when the mine shut down permanently after World War II, when that happened, why, we would come up seasonally, and this was the better building to stay in.
So, okay.
Starting in the late 40s, early 50s, why, it'd be my father and I, and sometimes my mother, she really wasn't into this. She was a very dedicated person into supporting my father, but after years and years of doing that, she'd rather stay in town.
You know? Okay, got that.
So it was just the two of us, and we were very comfortable. There was a lot of summer work then, usually resulting in a mill run at the end of every summer for a week or so.
Okay.
It was very pleasant. Memories.
So then, after that time, was there a period where this was not occupied or visited very often?
It was pretty much unoccupied. I went off on a tangent here of being a consulting mining engineer and traveling all over the place. And my leftover time was always up here, but there wasn't much of it. Okay. So for many years, the place was pretty much, I hate to use the word abandoned, but it must have felt abandoned.
Okay. So since that time, now you have been up here, as I remember, for roughly 7 years?
Yeah, starting in the fall of 07. So let's see, this is but my fifth, working on year number eight of full occupation, yeah.
Okay, and so the original, we're sitting in a very comfortable place. Obviously, the heat is working, water works, you have power, you have all the utilities. Did you do most of this work yourself? Did other people be involved?
Over the years, I did most of it. I pointed out that my solar panel, the collector, and the batteries are pretty much I put up. Fred helped me with a collector. And then that panel is something of Fred's design. And okay. He's got a little bit of everything in that panel. But that system works well. Everything else, the vinyl windows I put in, the old windows were single pane. And of course you couldn't see out of them in the middle of winter, full of ice, and very thermally inefficient. So putting those windows in made a tremendous difference on making the place more comfortable.
And it now is a single occupancy structure. It's no longer a duplex.
The other side of the duplex, there's a bedroom and bathroom over there, decommissioned for the winter, and a mudroom. You got to have a mudroom.
Okay.
But otherwise, this is perfect for a single residence, yeah. You, of course, identified my bed folding into the wall.
Oh, right. Now, I'm familiar with Murphy beds. Is this a version of that or something
similar? This is my own rendition. Yeah, it folds from the side rather than the end. Then it allows room for the couch to be there, see?
I see. Wonderful.
Works well.
So it's a high bed, then?
Yes, it's quite high. You can tell where the hinge point is right there. Then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I've only fallen out of it a few times, so it's not a problem.
Okay. Well, it was helpful to come up here and actually spend a bit of time on snowshoes and note that the hill is steep up from Independence Mine, not beyond one's capability, but it certainly was a nice bit of exercise. And there's switchbacks. I'm looking at going back down and saying, I understand you ski up and down.
When the snow is accommodating.
Okay.
This is not skiing snow.
This is not skiing snow, yeah. You noticed that Fred Trimble was here earlier, and he's on skis. He's always on skis. And he's good. He's very good at it, so he can handle it.
Hard surface, rutted in a little plate, waiting for the next drop to take care of that.
Yeah.
So one of the things that this area has experienced in the past are avalanches. I'm looking around, you're something of, you're above the bowl near the A-frame, but you're still in something of a bowl, and I'm looking at the mountains here. Have you witnessed a few avalanches?
Continuously. Sometimes you're surprised by what'll give way in the middle of winter. Other times you're amazed it doesn't give way in the middle of winter. It's quite a phenomenon. Excuse me. All of this mountainside, which is called Granite Mountain,
right,
which is my west wall.
Okay.
All of it is very snowslide prone. It's very, very steep. I marvel at the quality of the young skiers that'll come up here with their backcountry gear, climb that mountain, and ski down that face. And in every gully and every ridge, it's just beyond. I have trouble with that. I have no capacity to be able to replicate what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah. But it's fun to watch, anyway.
Right, right. Well, also coming on up here, we brought along our dog, and the first thing that happened was a ptarmigan was spooked out of a little bit of the brush and snow.
Yeah, about a half a dozen ptarmigan.
I've had some birders up here recently, and they left me some books. They were trying to find white ptarmigan.
That's what we saw. They're hard to see.
They're not common. Apparently, you know, now when I say white, most of the ptarmigan have a black tail. They have black feathers on the tail. You don't see them until they fly.
Right.
Because their wings cover that and makes them entirely white.
Okay.
In their camouflage for winter. But there is a variety that the tail is all white. And these lady birders were up here with their telescopes and everything, and we had birds everywhere. This was about a month ago, and we couldn't find a single white-tailed ptarmigan. You know, try to scare them up, make them fly to see if their tail had black feathers at the edges. The last time I came up the hill, I went through quite a flock. They flew, and I saw a lot of the white-tail.
Okay, so they do exist up here.
Yeah, they do. They do indeed. And they're mixed in. They're mixed. It's rock ptarmigan mixed with the white.
Now, are there other birds that are commonly seen here through the winter, for example?
Well, there's Maggie the magpie.
Okay,
she comes, and I put pieces of bread in a knothole out here, and she's learned how to stall correctly to grab that
and then fly away.
And there's a few ravens, but all of the little birds, all that you see in the valley, all the ones that come to the bird feeders, they're all gone.
They're gone.
Yeah. I've got a bird feeder out there, and it primarily in the summer attracts the golden crowned sparrow, which the three-noter.
Right.
They are kind of my favorite. It took a long time to build a group of birds that were willing to go to the feeder, but it's a family that has grown over the years, and now, and they don't care if you're sitting right next to it or not. You know, they're going to fly right by you to get to that bird feeder. It's fun to have them around.
So I'm wondering about rabbits, for example. Any hare in the winter?
No rabbits this high. The highest rabbit I ever saw was about 3,000 feet in the brush area down below. They wouldn't be up here. The only animal I'm aware of that doesn't hibernate is the pika. And they're also called the hay-making mouse.
Right.
In the summer months, you'll come along where you'll see they've got their hay out drying, and they've got to store that away then for the winter. But I think everybody, the parky squirrels, they've got a clock, and when it's time,
they're just gone. Right.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what's going on. The marmots, of course, are gone.
Sure. And you mentioned 3,000 feet down below. What? Where are we now in terms of elevation?
I call it four. I'm just under 4,000.
4,000.
But I'm, for round numbers, I call myself at 4,000 feet.
So the mountain ridge to the west, approximately how tall is that?
Another, let's see, 1,500 feet.
Okay, so we're talking maybe 5,500 or just short of Pioneer Peak.
Pioneer Peak being the taller, definitely. But these peaks all top out above 5,000.
Okay.
None of them at 6, but between the two numbers.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So in the wintertime, there are occasional people. Well, there certainly are many people down below that ski. What kind of visitors or passers-through do you find up in this area?
A lot, yeah. The valley of the Fishhook Creek, that valley has been dedicated to cross-country skiing in preference over snow machine activity.
Right.
So the people really use it very extensively. A lot of them are, especially weekends, they're coming through camp.
Right.
Skiing up to wherever, and I'll talk to them. I'll be outside skiing myself, and I've gotten acquainted with a lot of them. You know, where are you going today so I can watch?
So I've only gone a little ways down this trail here. Where does it go? Is there a trail or where can you go other than up if you were to go to the north?
It many years ago, it was a heavily used trail called Friendship Pass. The pass at the very end of the valley, the low pass, lets you go down into Upper Craggy Creek and Purchase Creek to the north. And a lot of the prospectors and other travelers would that were on foot in the early days would use that pass for access. In recent times, just casual wanderers, people that are out recreating, will use the pass in the summer, and some of them will go up there for skiing in the winter.
Okay. Okay.
But that's the ski activity when there's decent snow is very appreciable and always fun to see the people.
Okay. All right.
On their wedding day in 1900.
So, Dan, Mike Molesky here, still with Dan Renshaw in his cabin, and we're talking about a picture of a couple, very attractive couple. When was this taken, and who are they?
Let me read the back while you're looking at the front. William okay. Horning, he's 26. Pearl Horning is 19. It's their wedding day in 1900 in Iowa, just before they went west and also north, quote, to seek their fortune, unquote. So, Bill and Pearl played a big part in the development of the gold cord mine, along with Charlie Barthoff.
Okay.
So I've accumulated an enormous amount of information about them, good stories, excellent stuff. I just revel in telling the stories because they're such good quality.
So they left this place where their picture was taken and came here, and what did they do?
It's a very circuitous path they followed, believe me. They ended up in Nome. They wanted to go to the Klondike, but of course, by 1900, that's passé.
Right.
There's nothing you can find at the Klondike. But Nome was fairly new, so they made it to Nome. And they found some pretty good placer ground at Council, which is not that far from Nome.
Yep, been there.
And at Council, they placer mined successfully for a few years. And then Pearl became pregnant. And I always assumed that she had left and gone to Seattle because she was having difficulty with the pregnancy. But I talked to her grandson not too long ago, and he disabused me of that. He says, Pearl, a very headstrong lady, she was determined that she was not going to have her son born in the territory of Alaska. She had to be born in the United States so he could be president.
Okay.
So she ended up in Seattle to finish off her pregnancy. And she stayed there for quite a while because at the time, it is so fascinating to me, Mike, the Muckluck Telegraph. He's mining at Council, and all of the people in the area suddenly know there's something going on. It's called the Iditarod, or the finding of the Iditarod mining area. And how that travels, it's just an amazing thing. But they all uprooted and took off for the Iditarod. And Bill Horning was able to get some pretty good ground in the Iditarod area.
So you mentioned, you used the term Muckluck Telegraph.
Yeah.
For those listeners who might not be familiar either with Muckluck or how this would work, explain what that means.
Oh, it's a whisper in the air.
ESP between people living in rural areas. They all know what's going on.
They all know what's going on, and it is the most amazing thing to me, how they put things together. But it was a whisper, gold. 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 And they painted their wagon and they took off for something new, and they all together in this adventure. You know, the thrill of it all must have been outstanding. But they get to the Iditarod area, and I don't know precisely where Bill Horning located himself, but he felt very highly about the land he had found. Winter came on, and he left and went down to Seattle to visit with Pearl and to see their son. Bill then had a serious problem, and for the next several years he wrestled with this problem because it's hard to get to the Iditarod in the early days. Mm-hmm. You could go to Skagway, get on the railroad, and go to Whitehorse, and then wait for the river to open to get down. By the time you got down to the Iditarod area, you'd lost a lot of the season.
Right.
So that didn't work. So you could go to St. Michael at the mouth of the Yukon, and you could wait for the lower Yukon to open. That was worse. Then one day, he knew the solution was at hand, because the founding of the Iditarod Trail, which was actually, if you're going to give credit where it's due, there's this fabulous character among all of them,
right.
So fabulous. Gosh, I'll cough his name up here in a minute, but okay. he's a Japanese guy. And he had made a tremendous reputation for being a dog musher of extreme capabilities, where he could find trails where nobody else could. two summers ago, I heard rumors that some Japanese firm was making a movie about him, and they were down in the valley collecting information. Give me a minute, I'll give you his name. He was hired by what was called at the time the Seward Commercial, kind of like a Better Business Bureau for the people in Seward. The people in Seward were having hard times because the Alaska Central Railroad had located itself there and actually created the town of Seward in 1903. A lot of wonderful stories related to that. The two brothers, last name, I'm having trouble with names today, pardon me. Do you remember?
No.
Frank and John? Blaine.
Blaine, okay, got it.
Yeah, and anyway, the best of my reading was they were outstanding people, really good people. They were doing fine on creating the Alaska Central Railroad until they ran into some really serious going through what is now called the Loop District, which there was 7 tunnels required, and there was a lot of snowslide prone area, and it bankrupted. They couldn't make it. They reorganized as the Alaska Northern Railroad. The Blaines were out of it by this time, and didn't get much further. They finally laid track all the way to Kern. Didn't make it to Girdwood, not quite. So in the meantime, Seward's been building. It's been a lot of commercial activity, and there's hotels and bars and grocery stores and the whole thing. And when the Alaska Northern goes bankrupt, then now they have to figure out, well, what are we going to do? So they hired this Japanese guy.
All right, find the trail.
Wada? I believe his last name was Wada.
Could be.
Yeah. They hired Wada to find a trail to the Iditarod. Brand new area. There had to be a trail, and by gosh, they wanted a trail to go to Seward. So they hired Wada. And Wada went out, and in a short order, he found what became the Iditarod Trail. Usually the credit isn't given to him. It's given to various other people who came after him. Well, at that time, the Alaska Road Commission was a military operation.
Right.
given the responsibility for finding and improving trails as well as building roads. Took a long time for them to finally accept WADA's trail as the Iditarod Trail, and they put a lot of effort into improving it. So back to Bill Horney. When all of this was going on, he figured, there's the solution. What I'll do next spring, I'll get on a steamship out of Seattle that goes to Kinnick, and I'll do that early enough. I'll probably have to get off at Tyonek or someplace where the ice isn't preventing traffic. And I can walk to the Iditarod. It's only 400 miles. Well, that was nothing in those days. So that was the plan. So come spring, he gets on the proper boat. And, of course, the boats make stops at every port along the way, all along the Gulf and Southeastern. They finally get to Seward, and they leave Seward on schedule. And as they leave Resurrection Bay, they find themselves in a raging storm. And the storm is so severe that it wrecks their rudder. So for the next 2 weeks, all they can do is make great big circles out in the Gulf of Alaska. Way too rough to put anybody overboard with a sledgehammer to beat on the rudder. They somehow survived that, the ship itself and all of its complement. When it finally subsided sufficiently, they could go overboard and beat it straight. They finally made landfall, probably in Seldovia, somewhere along the coast, mm-hmm. where they could make a good enough repair to continue the trip. The end of it all was, by the time they got into Cook Inlet and Bill was unloaded, he goes to Kinnick and he finds the Iditarod Trail in breakup mode. It's too late. He missed his opportunity again. So there he is in this thriving community of Kinnick, which at the time was the only community in Upper Cook Inlet.
Right.
And it had a lot going on at that time with the discovery of the hard rock minerals in the Willow Creek mining district, as well as all the placer mining that was going on not only on Willow Creek, but in Cache Creek and Collinsville and so on. All right. of that was opening up. So Kinnick was the supply point for all of that. Bill is a accomplished carpenter and blacksmith. Very handy individual. The people who knew him always said that Bill could build you anything. Wood and metal, he could make fabricate whatever you needed. Well, he finds out that in Kinnick, they had lost their blacksmith. There's a blacksmith, a critical thing for a community in those right. days was having a blacksmith. There was a fully stocked blacksmith shop. But the blacksmith had either died or moved, or I can't get the details on what happened to him. So the community, when they found out he was a blacksmith, they begged him to stay. So on old drawings of Kinnick that you look at, you'll see a little notation, Horning's Blacksmith Shop. Well, he moved in, and of course the blacksmith, the first thing he does is make his own tools. But he had enough supplies that he was able to get himself established. And he kind of liked it. He liked the community, he liked the people, and he spent the summer there. Didn't even make it into the Iditarod at all. And he was doing very well commercially as a blacksmith. He got acquainted with everybody. Of course, you're talking about a community of between 300 and 500 people.
Okay.
But when fall comes, he leaves then to go back down to Seattle. The next summer, he comes back up with his wife and his child, and he builds a cabin for them in Kinnick, and he continues with his blacksmith work. It's doing very well. He thought he was doing better that way than he would have been in his mining. He gets acquainted, among other people, he gets well acquainted with Charlie Barthoff, and we've talked to the Barthoff family. They were a premier in this mining district as far as prospectors and developers. Some of the Barthoff family were the developers of, for example, the bullion mine, which was a very productive operation for many years. Charlie was the best of the bunch as far as being a prospector. Charlie could apparently, I never knew the man, but from reputation, he could just stand there and stare at a mountainside and know where to go up and move a rock to find something. He just had it, quality about him that he could do that. Well, Charlie had been working for another fabulous character in the local area by the name of Billy Martin. And Martin had the only mill in the valley of the Upper Fishhook Creek at that time. And Billy Martin was mining and milling the ore from Robert Hatcher's find on Skyscraper Mountain.
And we've talked about him.
And we've talked about him. And we need to get in a separate program talk about
just do
Billy
that,
Martin.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, Charlie is working as a millman for Martin. Millman had a shorter shift than most of the people working at a mine. Usually it was an 8-hour shift, maybe an hour on each end of it, attended to helping and so on. But he had some time to prospect in the evenings. And he'd come up the valley and look around, and he had noticed a coloration difference in the vegetation at a certain spot. And he went looking at it with a shovel, and he uncovered some quartz that was very rich, and he dug a channel, and he discovered the Goldcorn vein.
Wow.
Now he stakes claims on what became the Goldcorn mine where we're setting. The claims that he stakes are dated 1915, so we don't know which year he made the discovery, probably then. We don't know also what year he decided to do the development work on it. It was either late that year, but more likely probably 1916.
Okay.
So he goes down and he talks to Bill Horning, the blacksmith, down at Connect. And the conversation must have went something like this. Bill, look at this rock that I've got here. It's typical of a new find that I've made. I'm calling it the Goldcorn Mine. And Bill, well, that's interesting. You know, why are you showing me? Well, Bill, I need a partner. And I want you... I want you to join the effort and become a partner in the Goldcorn mine. Really, he says, look, I'm a placer miner, kinda. I'm a blacksmith and a carpenter. I don't know anything about hard rock mining. Hey, Charlie says, don't worry. I need a carpenter and a blacksmith and whatever talents you've got. I really need that. And I know the community does too, but I'm going to rip you out of here and take you up to the Goldcorn mine. So they form a partnership that becomes very durable. They come up here, and if it wasn't covered with snow, I could show you where their first wall tent was established. The outline is still there in the moss. And they're quite a ways away where they had that set up from the mine because they wanted to be clear of fly rock from blasting and so on.
So this is what you've just described is the... really, the story of how, in a circuitous way, Mr. Horning comes to be a founding partner of the Goldcorn Mine.
Yeah. And everybody's story is that way. And yours, mine, we all have this circuitous path where we arrive at where we're sitting at the moment. It's never a straight line.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is we're going to stop here at the beginning, the very beginnings of the Goldcorn Mine, and then we'll be picking up with the rest of the story. There's been a long history. We've got literally 100 years of 100 history.
100 years. This is our centennial, yes.
So there's a lot to be said, and I'm going to pause here. Mike Malevsky, Dan Renshaw in the cabin on the Goldcorn Mine property above Independence Mine.